Pumpkin.
I love you, honey bunny.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
Any of you fucking pricks move! And I'll execute every motherfucking last one of you!
Once upon a time in podcast-occupied France, there was Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man hell-bent on revenge and eager to kill anyone who stands in his way.
Mike Tricio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. Never been characterized that way, but thanks.
But it's oddly fitting, right?
Like, yeah, you're not wrong, so it's okay.
Right. I look forward to experiencing your adventures out of order.
I would hope my bloodlust became apparent after the podcast games, so
boom, callback.
There are four people that listen to this. You're welcome.
Yeah, they feel rewarded that they've been listening
yeah
this whole time. They're like, wow, I get the reference. All right, now if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, essentially we start with some film news and then we move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. After that, we will move on into our featured review. This week, we are reviewing the eighth film from director Quentin Tarantino, The Hateful Eight. So let's move on to some film news, Mike. Why not?
Yeah, that's normally how it works.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe if you would just let me get to it.
I don't want to step on your toes, so I'm sorry.
So just a couple things for film news this week, one of which the other day this came out. So a while back, a release date was set for Christopher Nolan's next movie, and nobody knew what it was.
Okay.
And now we kind of have an idea of what it is, so I'm going to tell you what that is. So Christopher Nolan's next movie will likely be a World War II drama set in France.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I'm in. That's
yep.
You know, I was really curious what he was going to do after Interstellar, because that movie was so huge and expansive, and like,
yeah,
it was almost necessary for him to do something on a smaller scale.
Right.
And
much more grounded in reality also.
Yeah, exactly. And, I love what he's been doing, like blockbuster-wise, but I feel like I've been wanting for him to do a smaller scale film for a long time. And I'm sure, like, this will still be a pretty big, expensive movie, big budget, everything like that. But, yeah. You know, it's not crazy sci-fi adventure ridiculousness like Interstellar or Inception or, you know,
right.
And it doesn't have Batman in it, you know. It's...
So is it even worth it then, Mike?
I mean, I would watch a World War II drama with Batman in it. I think that actually would be pretty
Yo.
Awesome.
I didn't know I needed that, but now I do.
Get on that DC Universe. What are you doing?
Forget this Dawn of Justice thing.
Right, we need Dawn of Nazis.
it's Captain America 1, but with Batman.
Yeah. Exactly. This movie is going to be based on the Operation Dynamo evacuation, where a bunch of British soldiers were evacuated from France as the Nazis were attacking. And it will be filmed on the glorious 70mm.
Beautiful.
Which we're going to be talking about in a little bit, because we both saw The Hateful Eight in the 70mm Roadshow edition of the film.
Yeah, I don't think it's out in not that version, right? So far?
Not yet. It opens wide in regular version on January 1st.
Oh, the joys of living near New York City.
Exactly. Yes, and we will be talking about The Hateful Eight in a little bit and about that format soon. But needless to say, I think we're both fans of the format.
Yeah.
And so that's exciting. I know Nolan also did the same with Interstellar. That was also shot with 70mm film.
Oh, really?
Or at least it was projected on 70mm.
The more you know.
And so the fact that this movie was being shot in 70mm... he had a conversation with Quentin Tarantino about like shooting on film and their various careers. And Tarantino mentioned the fact that Nolan will be shooting on 70mm, like offhandedly.
That's awesome. We were talking about it. Now that 100 theaters have the 70mm projectors for the roadshow thing for Hateful Eight.
Yeah, might as well.
Will it be utilized or will those be permanent? I don't know. Fun.
I hope so.
Guess we'll have to find out.
Yeah, I think there's a lot you can do with that format, so I'm excited to see, you know, where it goes from here.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm always excited for new Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this will be cool.
Yep. And then moving on from that story, you did want to mention that Mystery Science Theater 3000 has officially been funded.
Yeah.
For more than the 12 episodes that we were originally going for.
Yeah, yeah. I remember last time we talked about it, we were saying, oh, they'll probably get the 3.3, which I think was 6 episodes.
Yeah, we were talking about it when it was like about halfway through the Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
And they hadn't even made 6 episodes yet. Or they hadn't even reached 6 episodes. Like, they had reached 3. We knew we were getting at least 3.
Right.
But they hadn't even reached 6, and we were like, it'll probably get 6, but we don't think it'll go any further than that.
Yeah, maybe 9.
Maybe 9. Like, if we're lucky.
Yeah.
And then the last, like, 2 or 3 days of the campaign... they just kicked it into overdrive. They had like a big telethon. They were going out public, like doing a lot of publicity for it, and turned out a lot of good stuff happened there because they made their goal and they even made it past the goal. They're doing 14 episodes now.
They made it past their farthest stretch goal, which is amazing. So we get 14 new. I believe it's 13 episode season and a holiday special is what we're going to be getting.
I believe that's what it is. And it was the biggest film/TV Kickstarter of all time.
Yeah, it beat Veronica Mars.
Yeah, Veronica Mars was the thing. So that's pretty cool.
Suck on that, Veronica Mars, I guess.
and they also announced several other people who are going to be in the writer's room of Mystery Science Theater, and that's really exciting. People like Dan Harmon and Justin Roiland, Rob Schraub, Dana Gould, Ernest Klein. A lot of people who are really really talented people, especially Dan Harmon, Justin Roiland.
That's going to be the best thing ever.
Yeah, so that's exciting. For those unfamiliar, they created Rick and Morty together. Rob Schraub has also worked with Dan Harmon on Community and as well as on various other things. Dana Gould's a comedian. He's worked for The Simpsons. Ernest Klein wrote Ready Player One.
Right. Yeah, I don't remember if last time we talked about it, but Patton Oswalt is announced as a cast member.
Right, yeah, I think it did happen after we talked about it.
I don't remember. So this is going to be the best thing that's ever happened, probably.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. And I know they're starting to film soon, I believe, or they're doing pre-production in January, I think.
Yeah, so. I think they said they're starting, and then they're shooting for the end of this year, end of 2016 area.
Cool. Yeah, well, hopefully it gets purchased by Netflix or something soon.
That much support that came out for it.
Yeah, so. I feel that people really made a statement with it, so I'm pretty excited for more Mystery Science Theater. It's gonna be a good time.
Yeah, what a future we live in.
Yeah, we live in a future where if something we like is not there anymore, we can just throw money at it, and then it can come back.
Yeah, it's great.
Which is potentially dangerous, but I think...
but so far, we haven't messed it up yet.
In this instance, I'm pretty okay with it.
Yeah, definitely.
And then one last bit of film news. On Christmas Day, Radiohead released an unused theme song for Spectre that they recorded. So I guess what happened is they originally did the theme song for Spectre, and then it was rejected, and so they ended up going with Sam Smith's version.
Right.
But I don't think anybody knew that Radiohead.
Yeah, I don't think they announced that at all.
Christmas Day, it was like, oh, here you go, guys. Here's the theme song for Spectre that we made, and everybody was like, wait, what?
It's pretty cool. We listened to it. I dig it, I guess. I'm not a very big Radiohead fan, but I respect the fact that they're all just like, this is our music, we're going to do whatever the fuck we want with it, a lot of the time. Like, they give away albums for free and stuff.
Right.
Which is awesome. So it's cool that, like, you wouldn't expect that the song that they wrote, presumably, like, that it was rejected, that they would be able to release it. But because it's Radiohead, they're like, we're going to do it anyway. And it's cool. It fits... I saw a video that has it synced up over the opening credits of Spectre. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't see that.
It was pretty cool. It fits the, like, very off-putting, like, hentai thing that was going on during all that. Yeah. It fits that way better than Sam Smith being sad about being broken up with or whatever was going on with that.
Yeah, well, how do you think this compares to Sam Smith's song, like, Writing on the Wall?
I don't know. I wouldn't say it's better. It's just different, I guess. Okay. It's cool. It was interesting to hear the, like, similarities between them, though. Like, there's a lot of similar, like, musical phrases or whatever, however you say that.
I feel like there's, like, Bond flourishes that are, like,
right.
In almost every one of the Bond theme songs. Like, they have, like, similar notes that they have to hit.
Yeah. So it was interesting to hear that, you know, them together like that. But, I don't know. What'd you think, Mike?
I like the song. I don't know. I liked it a lot more towards the end. I feel like it grows over time. But I don't know. I mean, I've seen a lot of people ragging on the Sam Smith song.
Yeah, people bash that really hard.
And I kind of like it. I think it's grown on me over time too. It's catchy.
Fair enough.
You know. So I don't know. I think they both work as James Bond theme songs. Obviously, the producers ended up going Sam Smith one. I feel like that one was more marketable.
Yeah, you know? Which is the obvious decision or reasoning for why they went with it.
Yeah, like I feel like the Radiohead version is like a little odd. It's a little like esoteric, and you know that makes sense. But
it's Radiohead.
So. But you know, I feel like especially after Skyfall was such a huge hit, Adele's song Skyfall was a huge hit, and I feel like they wanted to try to recapture that and. I don't think they did, like, The Writing's on the Wall was not nearly as big of a success as Skyfall.
I don't think they came anywhere close to that, not even.
But it definitely had a better chance of being that hit
than a Radiohead song did.
I did like this Radiohead song used the word Spectre in the song.
It did, like, quite often as part of the chorus, I think.
Yeah, not in Sam Smith's version. This is the word Spectre.
Wow, I never even realized that. It's, like, so much more... It's so obviously a ploy to just put a pop song as the theme song when you put it that way.
Yeah.
Oh, well. That's what we got, so.
Indeed. But yeah, all right. I guess that's it for film news. There really wasn't that much to discuss over the past few weeks. I feel like, you know, Christmas time, everybody's kind of like slowed down.
Yeah.
There's not that much going on.
No. Although, I guess now that I think about it, Golden Globe nominations came out, I think.
You're totally right. But I feel like that says more about the Golden Globes than it does about us. That we didn't remember that at all.
I was just thinking, I was like, I think it's been like three weeks since we've done film news. How could nothing have happened? Oh, right. The Golden Globes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, do you want to talk about the Golden Globes? I feel
I don't know.
If you do, I want to, like, I'll have to pull them up and see what was nominated. I genuinely, I have no idea.
I don't know what was nominated, but I remember that that had happened.
Yeah, okay, so, okay, all right, so, I actually
there's film things involved in that.
I did have a lot of thoughts about these, actually, so.
Oh, I'm glad they've come to you.
So for best drama, best motion picture drama.
Yes.
There's Carol, The Revenant, Room, Spotlight, and a little movie called Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
So that's pretty awesome. I'm actually pretty stoked about that.
Yeah.
And then this is always like this category I hate like every year. Okay. Best motion picture musical or comedy.
Right.
The Big Short,
okay.
Joy, The Martian,
what?
Spy and Trainwreck.
What? What? That doesn't make any sense.
Right?
Wait, read those again.
The Big Short, Joy, The Martian, Spy and Trainwreck. The Martian is not a comedy or a musical.
Correct.
There is humor in The Martian, but it is not a comedy.
Not a comedy.
Joy, I have not seen, but I'm pretty sure it's not a comedy.
Probably not.
According to it's a Wikipedia page. It's a biographical comedy drama.
Oh, sure. Put comedy in there. Why not?
I feel like it's more of, I mean, I guess I haven't seen it, so I can't say for sure, but it just seems like it's way more of a drama than it is a comedy. And The Big Short, I mean, also sort of a comedy drama, but I feel like it's more heavily towards the drama side.
I would think. I haven't seen either of them, but I don't know.
But it's an odd thing. How do you justify, like, The Martian being in comedy and Mad Max being in drama?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, technically Mad Max is a drama.
Just because there's no action category.
Yeah, exactly. There's no action category. Like, that's the thing. You have by having these two categories, you have studios submitting their movies into what they think they have a chance at winning.
Right.
So, like, The Martian could win Best Comedy Movie because they want to give an award to The Martian.
Right. Yeah, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, even though it's not a comedy. Like,
yeah.
It's odd.
Isn't that what happened with, Orange is the New Black? Although that might have been the Emmys.
That was the Emmys, yeah.
But it's the same thing where they were drama for 2 years, and then the third year they were like, oh, we're going to go with comedy.
Yeah, they were. No,
or the other way around, or whatever.
They were comedy for, like, the first year, and then they stopped. Yeah, it was, it's a whole bunch of nonsense. Whole bunch of nonsense. And then what else? I mean,
I don't know what else is nominated since clearly we didn't research it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to go through them real quick. Oh, one of the cool things, Sylvester Stallone was nominated for Creed for Best Supporting Actor.
Nice. Good for him.
Jennifer Jason Leigh was nominated for The Hateful Eight, Supporting Actress.
Really?
Yeah. Which was interesting because I think she's good in the movie, but I feel like there's a lot of other characters in that movie who have a bigger spotlight, and we'll talk about that later.
Right.
Speaking of spotlights, Spotlight's nominated for Best
Picture. What a beautiful segue, Mike.
I didn't even want to mention Spotlight, but I just saw, like, the word Spotlight, and I was like, oh, I gotta...
Gotta do it.
Gotta do it.
The joke was there. You can't not do it.
Yep. Best Director, Todd Haynes for Carol, Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu for The Revenant, Tom McCarthy for Spotlight, George Miller from Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, my God.
And Ridley Scott for The Martian. Best Screenplay, Emma Donahue for Room, Tom McCarthy and Josh Singer for Spotlight, Adam McKay for The Big Short, Aaron Sorkin for Steve Jobs, and Tarantino for The Hateful Eight. And then you go to the TV categories. Best Drama, Empire, Game of Thrones, Mr. Robot, Narcos, and Outlander.
Okay.
So, well, that's pretty different than, you get from your Emmys. You know,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And then Best Musical or Comedy, Orange is the New Black.
There it is.
Casual, Mozart in the Jungle, Silicon Valley, Veep, and Transparent.
Okay. It's a pretty interesting category there.
Yeah, I have no idea what Mozart in the Jungle is.
Me neither.
Oh, it's an Amazon show.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. I'm glad that those shows are at least getting recognition at award shows.
Yeah, like, I mean...
They could have totally just been ignored if they wanted to be, like, all hoity about their format.
Well, I mean, they're recognizing Netflix.
Right, that's what I mean. Like, that Netflix and Amazon are being part of it.
Yeah, that's good. And I think, that was definitely a question of how they were going to go about that for a little bit. Because, like, I remember the first time Netflix was nominated for stuff was because House of Cards came out. And I feel like people were like,
right.
Well, House of Cards is such a highly produced show and everything like that. Like, it's crazy that this wouldn't be nominated for Emmys. And so...
Right.
So it got nominated for Emmys.
There you go.
But yeah, a couple. And Aziz Ansari is nominated for Master of None. Let's see. What else is here? Lady Gaga is nominated for American Horror Story Hotel.
that's amazing.
A couple of Fargo nominations here. Patrick Wilson and Kirsten Dunst.
All right. I can support that.
Yeah.
I hope Kirsten Dunst wins. She turned out to be amazing. During season two.
Yeah,
for a while, I was like, really? Like, stop. Come on. Like, the first couple episodes.
Right. She went you over.
Yeah.
All right. And I guess some other stuff. Oh, Mark Rylance is nominated twice. Once for Bridge of Spies. And then once for some TV show called Wolf Hall.
Some TV show called... well, that's cool, I guess.
I mean, I've never heard of it.
Me neither.
It's a BBC show.
Yeah, well, that answers that question.
I was also at the Emmys. It was Sunday for Emmys. It's a miniseries category. A lot of times, like, I'll watch miniseries and stuff, but, like, I don't know, when there's a category at an award show for something that you haven't seen any of the, like, nominees right. for, it's hard to care.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know? And at the Emmys, it's always the miniseries category. It's always like, we're going to be on this for a half hour.
Yep.
So I must just glazed over while Wolf Hall was getting nominated for stuff. At the Emmys.
Good job.
All right. Well, I guess that is our impromptu review of the Golden Globes nominations.
Yeah, so stay tuned for the all Golden Globes episode we do.
Right, which will be something. Ricky Gervais is hosting the Golden Globes again.
Yes.
This year. They're going to be, actually, they're soon. January 10th.
Whoa. We're quite unprepared for everything.
But yeah, he's hosting again, January 10th. Be there, be square. We'll give you our review the day after.
Tune into our Twitter accounts for our live tweeting.
Yeah, I probably will be. You'll probably be skipping it, I imagine.
Well, yeah, I'll probably be playing Dungeons and Dragons. Let's be real.
Right. All right. So I guess that's it for film news today. So let's move on to our discussions.
Yes.
And speaking of Netflix shows, we both have Netflix shows we want to talk
about. Oh, yeah. Look at that.
Man, killing it with segues today.
Synchronicity.
So what did you want to talk about, Mike?
So I want to talk about the new documentary that just came out, or documentary series, or I don't know, whatever you want to call it, on Netflix, called Making a Murderer. And this is a 10-episode documentary, sort of like The Jinx, that follows a court case that took place around this guy Stephen Avery in Wisconsin, who was convicted of a rape in 1985 and then later exonerated on DNA evidence in 2002, proving that he was not the rapist. And then they released him. So that's the episode one is kind of like that sets up the whole story for what happens. And so he sues the police department in the state, excuse me, for damages since he was in prison for 18 years for a crime he didn't commit. And then suddenly a body turns up on his property.
Ooh.
And it's on very suspicious circumstance. And it's about the whole rest of the series is about that murder trial that happens in 2005, I believe it was. And it's absolute insanity, and if it's something that if you want to be mad about, like, the current state of the criminal justice system, watch this and just have your mind blown at the complete, like, lack of context that everything is taken. It's crazy to see what happens. So do that. And it's crazy. Netflix somehow has this ability to make everything bingeable. This is a documentary about a court case, and somehow I was, like, watching 5 episodes at a time. Like, I don't know. it was pretty wild. And it has this really interesting effect where I can't really tell if the filmmakers were there for all of it, because it has a lot of interviews from today, like, 2015 or something like that. But then most of the other stuff during the court cases is news and media footage and courtroom footage. And I don't know if it was something that the filmmakers were making a documentary about Stephen Avery being released on the from his the rape conviction, being exonerated for that. And then this other thing just happened while they were making a documentary about that, or they made they knew that this happened and wanted to tell the whole story.
Right.
Because the way it's presented, it seems as if it's a very fly-on-the-wall style documentary. And it really seems as if they just happened to be there while this was going on. So it creates a really tense and suspense feeling to the documentary because it's the way it's presented as if you're sitting in the courtroom. Most of it is courtroom footage. Which is really interesting to see how the actual trial plays out. So I think people should watch it because it is also an important story, the just like grievous miscarriage of justice against Stephen Avery. So watch that.
Okay, yeah, I've heard really good things about that, and there's been like a renaissance of like documentary true crime stories.
Right.
over the past couple of
years. True Crime really blew up.
like this this show, Make Murder of the Jinx, on HBO, Serial, the podcast.
Right. That there's that American Crime Story, I think, or is that the FX one?
Well, that's
that's dramatized, but
yeah, that's like that's supposed to, I think what that is, it's going to be like a different crime story, as like it's from the guys who do American Horror Story.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Well, then never mind then.
And it's like going to be an anthology series where every season is like a different famous case.
Right.
But it's, you know, a dramatized version. It's not like a documentary of
right.
Like, that's going to be the O.J. Simpson case.
Right.
Which, I don't know. I feel like that's going to be really weird.
Yeah, that's going to be really weird. I feel like if there's one court case that no one really needs to hear anything extra about, it's the O.J. Simpson case.
Yeah, you're probably right.
But, I mean, I guess it'll still be interesting no matter what's going on.
That cast is really odd, if you've seen the trailers for that show. Cuba Gooding Jr. is playing O.J. Simpson.
Right.
John Travolta is playing Robert Shapiro, I think.
I think so.
David Schwimmer is playing the Kardashian guy.
Right.
Forget his name.
That's, you don't need to know.
And other ones as well. It's going to be I'm probably not going to watch it unless I hear like tremendous things.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah. But so. We'll see.
What do you have for us today, Mike?
Well, while you were expanding your mind, trying to, like, really getting to the bottom of the American justice system.
Yes.
I was giggling to myself watching Bob Odenkirk and David Cross do funny jokes.
I mean, it depends, you know, everything's right from a certain perspective.
Because,
as Obi-Wan would say.
One of the, true. from a certain point of view.
Right. Excuse me.
In addition, like, Netflix come out with a lot of shows in the past couple months, and really over the past couple of years. But the past couple months, it just seems like there's been, like, a constant stream of new shows. One of which is a show called With Bob and David, which, so I'm a big fan of a show called Mr. Show, which is a show that Bob Odenkirk and David Cross did back in the 90s. And it was a sketch comedy show that aired on HBO for 4 seasons. And that show, like, most sketch comedy today has at least some kind of influence from Mr. Show. Like, people like comedy geeks love that show, and the people who make comedy now grew up on Mr. Show, kind of thing.
Right.
Plus, a lot of people who worked on Mr. Show went on to do awesome stuff, Scott Aukerman, Paul F. Tompkins, Dino Stamatopoulos, Scott Adsit, Brian Posehn, Sarah Silverman, and Jack Black were both on Mr. Show. Tom Kenny was part of the cast.
It's pretty wild to look at the cast or writer's room of that show, who I believe were mostly nobody.
When the show was airing, like, they were like, you know, they were just people. They were just, they were nobodies. With Bob and David is like a reunion of Mr. Show. It's 4 episodes. It's Bob Odenkirk, David Cross, and pretty much every significant person from Mr. Show is back. I mean, there's no Jack Black or Sarah Silverman, but there is Scott Aukerman, Paul F. Tompkins, Brian Posehn, Dino Stamatopoulos, I believe, is in the writer's room, and a whole bunch of others. There's also appearances from Keegan-Michael Key. Padgett Brewster has an appearance. It's just a really good time. like, Bob Odenkirk and David Cross had, like, a really distinctive sketch comedy style, the way they transition between sketches, and just, like, an oddball sense of humor. And that hasn't changed at all in the 20 years since Mr. Show's been off the air.
Nice. That's awesome.
And it's really cool to watch them do this kind of stuff now, especially, like, Bob Odenkirk has actually become, like, a really good dramatic actor in his own right.
Yeah.
And David Cross, you know, he had Arrested Development for a long time, and, you know, they both grew and did, like, really cool, awesome stuff, and it's cool they came back to do this thing that they did a long time ago.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, and there are some phenomenal sketches in With Bob and David that stand up to, you know, the old Mr. Show ones. There's one in particular in episode 3, which is like one of the best sketches I've seen like all year, like all like a lot, for a long time. It's really good. A lot of really good stuff. And there's just funny bits like at the end of episode 2. There's a recurring joke throughout the episode where you know, they keep saying they will die and meet 72 virgins in heaven.
okay.
And then at the end of the episode, the 72 virgins come out, and it's all a bunch of, like, nerdy dudes who are who keep asking them questions about, like, it's like, hey, David, when's the Arrested Development movie going to happen? It's like, oh, Bob, are you making any more Breaking Bads?
That's awesome.
And stuff like that. It's a really funny show. Definitely check it out. There's the four episodes, and I haven't watched it yet, but there's also an hour-long behind-the-scenes documentary about the making of With Bob and Dave and how it all came together. So that should be really cool, too. But yeah, With Bob and David, really good stuff. So check that out.
There you go.
Yeah. All right. So
Netflix, killing it.
Yeah. Netflix really is killing it. Like, this year alone, I mean, With Bob and David came out, right? Daredevil and Jessica Jones came out. Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp.
Yep.
BoJack Horseman Season 2.
Yep.
Plus, you know, The Orange is the New Black had a new season. House of Cards had a new season. Yep. Sense 8 came out, which I'm about halfway through now, and it's awesome.
All right.
Narcos came out. Bloodline came out. I feel like
it seems like everything they're doing, everyone is loving.
Yeah. Like, I can't think of many shows they've had that have been, like, failures.
Right.
Hemlock Grove, maybe.
yeah.
Nobody really liked. Or Marco Polo.
Right.
But,
I feel like people didn't like Marco Polo only because at every opportunity Netflix tried to get me to watch it. I'm sure it's a cool show, but I'm not going to watch it out of spite of Netflix.
See, I feel like they missed out on a great marketing strategy where they...
I'm so ready for whatever shitty pun you're about to make.
Wouldn't it have been great if they hid Marco Polo like among the things, and every once in a while they played a soundbite that just said Marco.
You're the worst.
And you heard another soundbite say Polo, and it like pulled you over to where the Marco was.
Wow. And then it was just a link to play start episode one.
Yep.
You're terrible.
I feel like that would have been amazing.
This is why you're not in marketing.
That and many other reasons. All right.
Nope, so... that's the only reason, Mike.
All right. So that wraps it up for our discussions, I think. So let's move on to our feature review of The Hateful Eight.
What make a man brave a blizzard, kill in cold blood? I'm sure I don't know. You'd be surprised what a man would do. You're starting to see pictures, ain't you? Got room for one more?
I ain't too anxious to be handing out rides.
Real trusting fella, huh?
Not so much. Ain't no way I'm spending a couple of nights under a roof with somebody I don't know who they are. So who are you? Okay, everybody, hear this. I'm taking this woman to hang. Rewards $10,000. That money's mine, boys.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Hold on! You think I'm in cahoots with that fella or her?
That's my problem, boy. I don't know.
One of them fellas will kill everybody in here.
Now we're talking!
Let's slow it down. Let's slow it way down.
You know I'm coming.
When you get to hell, tell them Daisy sent you.
You don't die now!
No one said this job's supposed to be easy.
Nobody said it's supposed to be that hard, neither.
That was from the trailer for The Hateful Eight. It is the eighth film from director Quentin Tarantino. It says so right on the poster. The film stars Samuel L. Jackson, Kurt Russell, Walton Goggins, Tim Roth, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Michael Madsen, Demian Bashir, and Bruce Dern, many of which I would consider the Tarantino all-stars. And the IMDb plot synopsis of The Hateful Eight is, in the dead of a Wyoming winter, a bounty hunter and his prisoner find shelter in a cabin currently inhabited by a collection of nefarious characters.
Wow.
So.
That sounds like it was written by Tarantino himself.
Yeah, I really like that description, actually.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one.
Various characters.
Yeah. Good job, IMDb.
Yes. So, I mean, I'm a big fan of Tarantino. I'm assuming you are as well, Mike.
Yes. You assumed correctly.
Yeah. I've been a huge fan of his movies forever. He would be in my list of like top five working directors today. I just love his movies. I feel like he hasn't made a bad one up to this point, and I love The Hateful Eight as well. I thought it was great.
I second that theory.
That's the end of the review.
All right, thanks for listening, everybody.
So long, everybody. You can email us at podcast@filmlist.com. before we get into our review for The Hateful Eight, okay. I guess we should describe the experience, because we saw this movie at the 70mm Roadshow presentation.
Yes.
At Lincoln Square in New York City.
Yes.
How do you feel like the Roadshow presentation affected your opinion of the movie? Do you feel like it added to the experience?
Yeah, I think it did. It felt much more like going to a show than going to movies do.
Right. Yeah, so...
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the idea. And it makes it longer. Basically, the difference between the Roadshow and the regular version, this is being projected on 70mm, for starters. It includes an overture, about like a 3 or 4 minute overture, composed of Ennio Morricone's score from the movie. It includes an intermission.
Yes.
Splitting the movie into two halves. And supposedly it adds like 6 minutes into the actual movie itself. I don't know where those 6 minutes are in the movie.
Yeah. It definitely makes me want to see the theatrical version.
Yeah.
Just so I know what the difference
a little
is.
Bit. Yeah. And I feel like I read somewhere that the movie's cut a little differently too in this version. Like there's a lot more long takes in this version as opposed to the version that will be coming out in wide release, that has a little bit more dynamic camera movement, I guess. So I love this movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's just Tarantino doing what he does best. It has a powerful ensemble delivering terrific dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very well structured. I thought, you know, it starts off and this, like the movie is in two halves.
Yes.
Right. And I feel like the intermission is actually almost essential to how this movie plays.
Yeah. That's the thing that makes me want to see the wide release version is that I don't know how it will work. I mean, it can be done, but I feel like it will be a totally different movie.
It could be, yeah.
Like, without that break and that setup, I don't know.
Yeah, it's gonna be a little odd. I mean, yeah, so the first half of this movie is almost entirely dialogue. And it basically just serves to introduce you to all the characters.
Right.
Which takes, like, an hour and a half.
Right, because it's Tarantino.
Because it's Tarantino. And that could be, like, tedious. That could be really boring. Mm-hmm. But I didn't feel like it was. I feel like there's so much energy going on in the movie. It's so good to look at, and all the performers are having so much fun just biting into this material.
Yeah.
And it just builds and builds. Like, even when there's not, like, tense stuff happening, it feels like there could be at any moment, you know?
Yeah, that's I think, the driving force of the movie is the just amount of tension that is going on between these eight people stuck in a cabin during a blizzard.
Right.
Like, that want to kill each other. Or that, it's crazy. Like, it's an hour and a half, the first act, of people telling stories. And it's exciting and interesting. And
right.
I'm not just sitting there like, oh, come on. I wanted them to keep talking. Like, yeah. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, they're great. But then the second half is really where the plot kicks in. Like, that's where, you know, the different machinations start to happen. And that gets more into the Tarantino-y violence aspect of it. So I feel like the intermission works really well because it's essentially splitting up two halves of the movie and kind of creating two different movies in the process.
You know? Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's like I look at it actually like Kill Bill, where Kill Bill Volume 1 is all the violence, and then Kill Bill Volume 2 is all the dialogue.
Yeah, you know? Pretty much.
Like, Kill Bill Volume 2 has some fight scenes in it, and the first half of this movie does have some, like, action and some, like, small things here and there.
Yeah.
But, you know, Kill Bill Volume 2 has some fight scenes in it, but it's mostly dialogue, and even, like, the final fight in Kill Bill is, like it's at a table. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, this, the Hateful Eight, I almost don't want to say it, but it, like, borders on masturbatory for Tarantino. It gets real close to just being...
Yeah. I don't think it borders. I think it is.
It is, yeah, but I...
But I love that. Like, I love watching that. Like, I can't, like...
Yeah. Yeah. I don't... I guess you're right. Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is I wanted to see Tarantino masturbate on screen. Because it doesn't take away from...
Put
it
that on the poster.
Yes. Film book cast. You're welcome, Tarantino. I'll be expecting an email. yeah, it doesn't take away from the movie, for me, at least. And I think that I could see in wide release earning the film a lot of bad negative reactions to people from people who are not, who don't want to revel in Tarantino going to see this movie and being like, no, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
But for us, it's not bullshit. So,
yeah, I'm actually really interested to see how this movie plays with Tarantino fans, because it requires a lot of patience.
Yes, you know what I mean? It does. Yeah. And I feel like doing the 70mm roadshow, the type of person who will go to that and to be excited about it is
the kind
going
of person
to like the movie
going
anyway.
To like the movie anyway, yeah. Yes. That's true. So, I am curious to see how this plays with a wide audience and with Tarantino fans, because it does require a lot of patience, and his movies have historically been, like, you know, it feels like his movies are almost on, like, eight, like, they're always moving, you know?
Right.
But, with Django, for example, was, like, basically an action movie.
Almost a superhero movie.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel this hews closer to Inglourious Basterds, which requires, like, a lot. It has, like, a lot of slow, very long scenes.
Yeah.
That are fascinating to watch. But, like, Tarantino's, like, some of Tarantino's fans who watch him for, like, the violence and for the movie references and, like, all that stuff, I feel like they might be turned off by it.
Yeah, it reminded me of the structure of Death Proof a lot also.
Yeah, I was thinking that
which,
too.
Which is about... Death Proof is like an hour and 20 minutes of people talking and then a half-hour car chase.
Yeah.
so this is a similar structure.
Right, definitely.
But I love Death Proof, so...
Yeah, I mean, this... And the thing about Hateful Eight is it feels like it takes elements from all of Tarantino's movies in, like, a weird way. It feels like it feels like the opening scene of Inglourious Basterds, but it's, like, the whole movie...
That's exactly what it is.
The plot of this movie is basically Reservoir Dogs, a group of people stuck in one location trying to figure out who's the traitor.
That's a good point.
It's similarly structured to Kill Bill, as I mentioned before. It's got that similarity to Death Proof, where it's just like an hour and a half of people talking, and then the violence happens.
Right.
It's a Western, like Django Unchained, and it's also, and like Django, it also examines the relationship of black people in the West during the time period.
Yeah.
I wasn't
expecting that for some reason. I mean, I should have been, I guess. It's Tarantino. He confronts race a lot in his films.
He does. I feel like he does it really effectively in this movie because it echoes a lot of the sentiment that's going around today.
Right. Yeah, definitely. It was real interesting to see the Confederate versus the Union. And then on top of that, it's a black Union soldier against the Confederate soldier in this.
Right.
So it was real interesting. I liked it a lot. And it felt like it served a purpose to build character and not just for the sake of it being there, like it is in Pulp Fiction with Tarantino's cameo. He's just, like, racist because he's racist, which doesn't really make any sense.
Right.
But in this, it builds the characters more.
Okay. So. Yeah. Definitely, and a lot has been made of the decision for 70mm for this film, because some people are saying, why are you doing 70mm for a film that mostly takes place indoors?
Right, yeah, that's a good point.
I would say that the film does often cut to the landscapes.
Yes.
Outside the cabin. And during its opening scenes, like before they get to the cabin, they're on those landscapes. And it looks phenomenal. It looks great. That opening scene, like that, just that opening shot of the Jesus statue.
Right.
In the snow that just hangs on for like 5 minutes.
For the whole opening credits.
Yeah.
It takes a long time.
Like, it looks awesome. But I think it does feel essential to me for the indoor scenes too, because it gives a greater sense of space for the actors. And like, it allows you to see more things happening in a scene.
Right.
And I think that is it's used really effectively in this movie, I think.
Yeah, definitely. We were talking about it. Quentin Tarantino was on the Nerdist podcast last week or a few weeks ago, whenever that was. And they asked him about how filming on 70mm affects how you direct things. And he said it doesn't really, except for the fact that the frame is gigantic. So normally things that are off the edge of the screen and you don't have to worry about are suddenly in frame. So, you know, there's a conversation going on at the dinner table, but you can see that guy who's standing all the way in the corner of the room now. So now you have to think about what he's doing and what his how is his character listening to the conversation? Is he not paying attention? And it really, it makes you much more aware of the fact that these people are all in one room and they are interacting with each other, even when they're not doing anything. I think it really adds to the tension of the film.
Yeah, no, I agree. Adding on to that, Ennio Morricone's score is terrific.
Yeah.
It's like pulse pounding. It raises the tension. It's just really intense. And I was referring back to the opening shot. Like, that opening shot just has like this, it's like a 5 minute thing of just like this Jesus statue as the music is just swelling and getting like more and more intense as the credits are rolling. And it's just so great. It's so great. And it's, you know, it's the first time Tarantino's ever used an original score in his movie, in his movies.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never noticed that. You're right.
And, Ennio Morricone is a legendary composer who did the score for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and several other spaghetti westerns, and also did the score for The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing. And this movie uses unused tracks from The Thing score that Ennio Morricone used during certain scenes. Yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah,
I did not know that.
Yeah,
I like that a lot. I think my favorite moment though with the score was when the two characters are putting the line out to the outhouse so they don't get lost in the blizzard.
Right.
And the score is like building and building and super shrill. And then it just cuts to silence as two people are like sitting there drinking coffee. It was just really effective. The way the score manipulates the audience into being tense.
It's
pretty wonderful.
Very true. Greg Nicotero did the special effects. Greg Nicotero, is somebody I've gotten to know a lot as somebody who works on The Walking Dead. He directs a lot of the episodes, and he's been a makeup artist for years. And he's one of the few makeup artists who I could name. It's like him, Rick Baker, and a couple others. But Greg Nicotero has been doing stuff for a while, and it's always kind of cool just to see his name, because it's like, yeah, Greg Nicotero.
I know that guy.
Because I see him, like, he's on Talking Dead a lot, and I see him like on various podcasts or whatever, and so he'll show up. He did the special effects for this movie and received second billing in the credits right after Tarantino for the special effects.
Wow.
Which is not the usual case. Usually special effects are like halfway through the credits, like in a tiny
print. That's a good point.
But right after Tarantino's name, just in big letters, special effects by Greg Nicotero. I thought that was interesting to note. And there is a lot of blood and guts happening in the second half of this movie that I'm sure Greg Nicotero was able to, like, he pulled them off really well.
There's some super ultra violence happening.
As you would expect. Now, performance wise, I mean, who do you think was the standout? Who do you think like really rose to the occasion for you?
By and large, Walton Goggins.
Yeah, I loved him so much.
Oh my god, he is amazing, and I hope this is the springboard for his career,
because
I think it should be.
Yeah, yeah. As a fan of Justified, who's been watching that show. I mean, that show just finished recently, but I've been watching it for years.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he's always been like the best part of that show. Like, it's a really good show, but he's always been like a step above.
Yeah.
You know, it's really cool just to see him get this like huge role in this Quentin Tarantino movie.
And he's alongside all these other huge actors.
He's a perfect actor for Tarantino's dialogue, and he just fits the role so well.
Yeah.
Also great in this movie, Samuel L. Jackson.
Of course.
as usual, you know.
Yep.
You know, pair him with Tarantino together, you usually get something good. Yeah. I think that's how it goes. And I also really like Tim Roth in this movie. I thought he was really good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Tim Roth is probably my second standout for me.
Okay.
I think. His the shift in his character is one, hilarious, which is amazing. and really, I don't know. It's right. Just cool. Yeah,
we'll get more to that in spoilers. But is there anybody who didn't like do it for you? Like anybody who you felt like that could have been more done with this character, or there could have been like maybe this role was miscast?
I wouldn't say anything like that, but I feel like I guess Jennifer Jason Leigh, she's amazing, but could have done more. I feel I would have liked to see her do more. I guess not that it was bad or anything.
Okay, I liked her a lot, and I thought she could have done more, but I feel like most of the movie, like, she's meant to be relegated to like the side, you know, like,
yeah,
she's meant to, like, she's keeping quiet and stuff, and the movie is ultimately about her,
right? That's true.
And she gets a lot more to do towards the end, but for me, I mean, Michael Madsen, I thought I liked him in the movie, but I feel like his character didn't have as much to do he could have, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. It sort of felt like he's playing Michael Madsen in a Tarantino movie is what his character is.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I can see that. He kind of just felt like he walked right off the set of Kill Bill.
Right. Yeah. He's just kind of like talking out of the side of his mouth, like looking up at people. I don't know. Like, that was kind of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what did you think of Kurt Russell?
He was phenomenal.
Yeah, he was really good.
I love Kurt Russell.
Yeah, I saw somebody comparing his performance to doing a John Wayne impression, which is like,
whoa, yeah, right. It is.
It's actually like pretty, it's pretty
which honest. Is also really funny in Death Proof. He does a John Wayne impression.
Yeah. Whoa, yeah, you're right.
so that's pretty funny, actually. But yeah, he basically is the whole, I didn't even pick up on that. The whole, his cadence of talking and all of that is basically John Wayne.
John Wayne. I also really like Demian Bashir. Doing his, an exaggerated Mexican accent.
Yeah.
he was really good. I mean, this whole cast was, like, really good. Fantastic, really.
Yeah.
And there are a couple other people who will appear. I'll save that for spoilers.
Okay.
But there are some other Tarantino regulars, as well. But the movie is very, very funny, very frequently funny, frequently intense, and often at the same time.
Yes, that's very true.
So, I mean, is there anything else you wanted to discuss before we get into spoilers?
No, I think we can move into spoilers.
All right, well, then let's do that. Let's move into spoilers for The Hateful Eight, starting right now. All right, we are starting spoilers for The Hateful Eight, starting right now. So we were saying the movie revolves around Daisy, and that's very much true. So the movie is about Kurt Russell's bounty hunter who has Daisy, who's taking her into town to get hanged.
Right.
But when they get to the cabin, all is not what it appears to be. And it turns out everybody else in the cabin, Oswaldo, Bob, and Joe Gage, were all working with Daisy.
Yeah.
They were all members of the same gang. And her brother, Jody, who is the leader of the gang, has been hiding under the floorboards the entire time.
Yes.
And that her brother, Jody, is played by Channing Tatum.
Yeah, which was really cool. It was cool to see. He's a great addition to the Tarantino ensemble.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it'd be cool to see him pop up in more Tarantino movies for the future. And yeah, so like many Tarantino films, everyone dies.
Yep, in disgusting and gruesome ways.
Yeah, the second half of this movie is like just escalating violence a lot of the time, and
yeah.
And it works really well. I mean, like, a lot of blood and guts, a lot of nuts getting shot off. And a whole host of other things. I was surprised to see that Bruce Dern and Kurt Russell were killed off as early as they were in the movie. Because Bruce Dern is killed off by the end of the first half. That's at the hand of Samuel L. Jackson. It's basically totally unrelated to the rest of the
movie. It's this odd subplot that's going on. I'm not really sure.
I mean, I think it's meant to establish Marky Warren as a force to be reckoned with, sort of.
Right. Yeah. It's a moment for his character.
Right. It's based on him, but it's I would have liked to see Bruce Dern have, like, a more central role to the movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, even so, I thought that whole sequence was amazing.
It's pretty wild.
That leading into the intermission where Samuel Jackson really goes all out in that role. Like, if I very much doubt this movie can get a lot of Oscar love, but if, like, just because it's not, like, the kind of movie that they would go for.
Yeah.
But Samuel Jackson gives, like, a powerhouse performance during that monologue specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like his best Tarantino stuff since, like, I don't know, it's like Say What Again in Pulp Fiction.
I was going to say, it's very reminiscent of that scene in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Where, you know, he's quoting the Bible and all that, like, that crazy stuff. But, yeah, I was... And then to end the first half on that scene,
yeah,
on that moment...
That was bold.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. It's pretty cool. It's really unique to have have Bob playing Silent Night on the piano as we're getting this, like, gruesome, disgusting story being told to us.
Right.
And then, last note, he closes the piano and we go to intermission. It's like, yeah. What?
I was shocked that it went to intermission when it did, because the movie just kept, like, flew by for me. Like, I feel like...
Yeah.
It's a 3-hour movie, and I feel like time just flew by. Like, I didn't feel like 3 hours at all.
Yeah.
So I was surprised that we were already at intermission when it right. came up.
Which is why I am interested to see the other cut of it.
Right.
Like, how does that intermission, or the lack of intermission, play with, because it builds so much tension to that moment.
Yep.
And then only to undermine it with intermission, but, it, like, effectively.
Yeah, yeah. Other stuff about the movie. So there's a recurring element in the movie where Marky has this letter from Abraham Lincoln
mm-hmm.
That he, you know, shows to people every once in a while. And at the beginning of the movie, Kurt Russell asks to see it and reads it. And it turns out that's a lie that Marky perpetuates to get by in white-dominated yeah. society. But, you know, and that hurts Kurt Russell's feelings, and it's this whole thing. But then at the end... Yeah. You know, the very last shot of the movie is Sam Jackson and Walton Goggins dying together.
Yeah, slowly bleeding out.
Yeah, these two guys who are so ideologically different.
Mm-hmm.
Reading this letter, supposedly from Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
And it's just like this oddly hopeful message, I think.
Yeah.
About the state of America and how, like, you know, these two guys who... You know, are so, like, ideologically different. I mean, Walton Goggins is, like, the Southern racist guy, and
yeah.
Samuel Jackson is a black man from the Union Army. These are guys who basically hated each other,
right.
But death sort of brings them together, and,
yeah.
like, reading this letter gives them, like, sort of hope for the future of America.
Right, yeah.
That's,
and it's also interesting, that's the only moment we... hear the whole letter.
Yes, that's true. I that's definitely intentional.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But I think that's cool. I like that moment. Then we talked about too after we saw the film. There's a couple times where the letter gets passed to somebody, and as it's passed, it crosses through a sunbeam, and it just, like, glows in this brilliant radiance.
Yes, yeah. And, very similarly to the briefcase in Pulp Fiction.
In Pulp Fiction, right. But it was funny to see the, you know, how glorious everyone thought this letter was and the power it held.
Right.
And then at the end of it, it's crumpled up, covered in blood.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting how, like, the people, even the people from the South, like Walton Goggins or Bruce Dern, like, they're still really impressed by the Lincoln letter, even though, like, they were from the South. Like, they hated
yeah.
Abraham Lincoln during the war, you know?
Yeah. And even by the end, we know it's fake, and it's still powerful. Yeah. Like, this, what it symbolizes. Yeah, I thought, I don't know, I liked it a lot. Like, every part of this is really good, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed this movie. I thought it was awesome. Is there any other spoilery things you want to talk about?
I don't know. I liked the... Well, we get a few moments of Tarantino voiceover, which is...
True, yeah. We Yeah, second half of the movie starts with narration that was not there in the first half of the movie.
Yeah.
Voiced by Tarantino himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun. I thought it was a really funny device. And it's only used twice throughout the movie.
Right.
And it was very similar to the same thing from Inglourious Basterds, where just, like, out of nowhere, there's a narrator.
Right.
And in that movie, the narrator is voiced by Samuel L. Jackson.
Right. Yeah, it's funny that we get. That's why I'm real interested in the difference between the 70 this cut and the other cut. Like, will that need to be there? Because there's no intermission break. Like, I mean, I get that it's like partly a joke because it's like a 15 minute intermission, and then they come back and he says, "We last saw our heroes 15 minutes ago." But he sets up the, you know, Daisy seeing the poison and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Will that be told linearly? Because that we have a couple time jumps back.
Ooh, that'd be
but there's no intermission, so like we there's I no. Know. I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting. So it would be cool. It would be cool to compare the two. But I did like that. After the reveal that someone's been hiding in the basement the whole time, we go back to the beginning of the day and see how they set everything up.
Right.
And yeah.
Yeah.
And then we find out Tim Roth is not. He's like this. That's the other thing. Yeah, I forgot. He's like this hoity, you know, high class
Englishman.
Yeah, high class Englishman who's a hangman who has very, very sophisticated views on justice and what that means. I forget what the quote is, but justice that's whatever.
Justice delivered without dispassion.
Right, yeah.
Is in danger of not being justice or something like
Or something like that. Yeah. Really cool and awesome. And then we just find out he's a member of the gang, and he immediately drops into like a Cockney accent, and he's just like an asshole.
Yeah.
It was cool. I was half expecting after he gets shot, which we see him like writhing on the floor for a long time after he's shot. I was just half expecting him to throw out a line like, you know, "I'm bleeding here," or whatever he yells in Reservoir Dogs. I thought would have been cool.
Yeah.
But I'm interested for this to come out in wide release, one, so I can see it again, as I've said a whole bunch of times, and two, so that someone can write an article about how it connects to the Tarantino-verse, because I want to know.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think it's mentioned in the movie, but one of the characters, I think Tim Roth's character, was nicknamed the Little Man in the movie.
Right.
In the booklet that we have, like, it says...
Right, which
like,
is also we got programmed.
They gave out programs at the Roadshow, which is pretty cool. They have, like, the characters, and they have, like, the nickname they all have. And so, like, John Ruth is called the Hangman, which they mentioned a bunch of times in the movie.
Yeah.
And then Tim Roth's character, it says the Little Man, which I don't believe they say that in the movie.
Right.
But the Little Man is the name of B.J. Novak, is B.J. Novak's nickname in Inglourious Basterds. So
right.
There is that.
there is that connection.
I'm just saying. But, yeah, I don't know. I feel like somebody did say something like one of the characters was connected to another Tarantino film in some way, shape, or form. So I guess we'll find out more as things go on. Django didn't really have too much from what I know. I remember...
It connects to Shaft or something like that.
I think there was something like that, yeah. But
oh my god, I can't remember it. Somebody's name was Von Shaft, and she's supposed to be like Shaft's grandmother.
Brunhilde von Shaft.
Right, yeah. Right, there you go.
Yeah, that was Django's wife.
Django's wife, yeah. But I don't know. I don't remember how it connects to the Tarantino verse, but
yeah, no,
I'm sure it does.
I remember there was one of the bounties that Django and Christoph Waltz go after.
Ah, that's what it was.
It like the last name is like the same as the last name from like True Romance, something like that.
Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. Yep. All right. So is that about to wrap it up, Mike? Do you think we're done?
I think I'm out of things to say.
Okay. Yeah, so obviously we both really enjoyed The Hateful Eight. It's another great Tarantino movie. Where do you feel like it ranks in Tarantino's filmography?
Ooh. I think I'd put it in the top five for me.
Okay, top five out of eight.
That's a good point. I forgot there's only eight. I mean, it's not my favorite.
Okay.
But it's up there.
Yeah, I feel like I might put it on par with like Kill Bill. Maybe a little below, but I have to rewatch it again and like really, you know, see where it would stand. My personal favorite is probably Inglourious Basterds, and then probably Pulp Fiction, and then probably Kill Bill, and then I feel like Hateful Eight would be up there, and then Reservoir Dogs, and then Django, and then like Jackie Brown and Death Proof.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. I was gonna say Death Proof might be my number one.
Really?
Yeah, I love
that
Death.
That is a fascinating opinion.
Yeah, which is odd, because this is the same movie. So, I mean, not exactly, but... yeah, well, it might be Reservoir Dogs, Death Proof, and then Hateful Eight, probably.
I think you stick to your guns. I feel like I've never seen anybody rank Death Proof as number one.
Yeah. It's close. I don't know. All right, so I'll go Death Proof, Reservoir Dogs, and then probably Pulp Fiction, then Hateful Eight.
Okay.
We've got top four.
Cool. All right, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
Find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And sometimes my D&D group and I stream our games. So if you want to check those out, you could go to twitch.tv/geonerd79.
Right. And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog, as well as all my podcasts at filmbook.com, like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Gotham, as well as our other podcast, The Complete Works, which is our which we've taken a few weeks off from. But yeah. We're coming back. We're going to be doing it again soon. Thank you for listening to Film Bookcast. If you're listening to this review or podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, top discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We produce so many different ones to start to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us next week when Mike and I are probably going to take a look at the films of 2015 and look back on our first full year podcasting for Film Bookcast.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. We've done a whole year of this.
I know, right? It's nuts. Remember back in the day, our first episode was the interview?
Right. That's right. Yeah.
Good old days.
Oh, I still miss that studio.
Yeah, we don't have a studio anymore. You know, it's a shame. But we do have the internet, though. Which is like the world's studio.
Well, deep mic. Real deep.
I mean, some of us have like professional microphone and headphones. Some of us are just, you know.
Yeah, some of us have one earbud and a laptop, so... don't judge.
All right. We're going to be doing that episode, and then we're going to be coming back to a normal schedule probably the following week with our new Complete Works, where we'll be discussing Nicolas Cage's role in Moonstruck.
Yes.
That should be fun.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We are out.